Hezbollah chief accuses the US of piling economic pressure on Lebanon by blocking investments in the country. Bahrain is holding parliamentary elections amid calls for a boycott in the absence of any opposition candidates. Also ahead, Ukraine says the war continues as its forces enter the city of Kherson following the Russian withdrawal. Our top story, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah has blasted the U.S. for maintaining an economic siege on Lebanon by forbidding investment or financial aid to the country. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah says the U.S. has contributed to Lebanon's political and economic crisis. We earlier discussed the issue in our review program. Let's hear what our guests had to say.
And I welcome everyone to the News Review Program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Lebanon's Hezbollah says that the resistance movement is unconcerned about the outcome of recent Israeli and U.S. elections, as polls do not affect the policy of Washington or Tel Aviv toward Beirut. Hezbollah Secretary General says all Israeli parties are similar in their crimes. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said he does not believe that there will be a withdrawal from or cancellation of the U.S. brokered maritime deal between Lebanon and Israel now that former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to return to power. Nasrallah argued the real guarantor of the deal is the power of the Lebanese army, people, and resistance. And referring to U.S. midterm congressional elections, Nasrallah said the U.S. policy toward Lebanon does not depend on which party is in power. Here he is.
The U.S. objectives are one, maybe they might change when it comes to how they lie, how pretentious they are, how, or their methods or their ways, or but in the essence, in their principles, they are fixed. And are the people of this region, we saw from none of these U.S. administration, from this great Satan, we saw only wars, we saw authority, we saw hegemony, we saw occupation.
Nasrallah said the U.S. is responsible for all Israeli crimes against nations in West Asia, as it was the U.S. who brought the curse of Israel into the region. He also blamed the U.S. for infesting Lebanon with Takfiri terrorists and creating an economic and political crisis in the Arab country. He said the U.S. continues to impose a siege on Lebanon by forbidding investment or economic aid to the country and relentlessly interfering in Lebanon's political process. And Nasrallah also touched on resistance campaign against Israel, saying the regime has banked on the exhaustion of Palestinians, but young Palestinians surprised the enemy with their attacks on Israeli forces. He said Israel had also bet on the exhaustion of the Lebanese people back in the 1980s when it attacked Lebanon, but it was later surprised by the people's resistance. Now joining us for the program is Paul Lurie from Berkeley, California, and Firas Al-Najim joining us from Ottawa, Canada. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Paul, I guess we'll start with you. Your initial thoughts about how much the West likes to portray as the impediment to the economic success of Lebanon is always Hezbollah. But Hezbollah always says that, look, it's the West that is always tying our arms. We can't get any kind of, international bailouts, any kind of funding into the country. We can't really do any kind of deals with any other country because of U.S. sanctions and blockades. Your thoughts?
Well, I would have to go with the assessment of Hezbollah in this case. And this is exactly the United States basically does whatever it wants to do. And in order to get it done, it pits various groups within a country or a society against each other. The United States can always find or it can purchase allies within a region. It did so in Afghanistan, and it's doing so in Syria, and it's doing it in Ukraine, and it does it in Lebanon as well. Provide resources to those who will follow the dictates of the United States. This is the way the United States divides and rules everywhere, with plenty of threats and weapons to back them up.
Thank you, Paul. And Firas Al-Najim, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Now, Firas, your thoughts on how the U.S. ties Lebanese hands economically, and so much of the hardship in Lebanon goes right back to the Pentagon and the White House.
Yes, I mean, this is just a type of strategy that's always failed. They did the same thing, with the Islamic Republic of Iran for over 43 years. So they're trying to tighten up the situation on the Lebanese nation to hoping that the Lebanese people will rise up against Hezbollah, and there's going to be internal conflicts and problems inside Lebanon. And this is just one of their strategies, that they have tried, and they have always failed in that. Hezbollah is a very strong force because of its resistance forces, their unification, how they're unified, how their leader is a great wise man, and he's a man that cares about his nation. He has released all the prisoners from the Israeli prisons by obviously arresting and prosecuting Israeli prisoners and Israeli IDF soldiers before, and then there was some negotiations through a mediation, because obviously Hezbollah does not recognize Israel in any way, so it was mediated through Germany at that time, and they released all their prisoners. And but they are the hope for the region and for the country, because they're a force that cannot be defeated and cannot be taken out in any kind of way. They have tried for many years. Israel is supported by most of the world countries. They have provided them all kinds of technology and intelligence and weapons, advanced weapons, and they cannot deal with this force inside Lebanon. Hezbollah also right now is obviously, today was the commemoration of the Martyrs Day, and this is a day remembering all the martyrs that were sacrificed fighting this battle to liberate Lebanon. And Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah elaborated very much on the problems that with the Israelis and the Americans, in saying that no matter who comes into power in the U.S., the Republicans or the Democrats, it's the same thing, because they both, by foundation, by establishment, support the Zionist regime and help them commit more crimes and empower them to commit more crimes. There's just different ways of dealing with things and different ways of proposing, the scenario. But at the end of the day, they both support the Israeli regime, and they're both criminal regimes, and that's why Imam al-Khomeini, the one that established the revolution of Iran, he said that America is great Satan, a shaitan al-akbar. And now today we are seeing that this label of U.S. is more clear to everybody in the world because of all the crimes they have committed, not just in Palestine, everywhere in the world. Everywhere they put their hands, everywhere they get involved and infiltrate, and anywhere they invade, they destroy the country and leave it in the worst conditions with the worst type of systems as well.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program, and stay safe, both of you. Firas Al-Najim, they're joining us out of Canada, and Paul Lurie joining us from the States. That's a wrap for the segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Now, the United Nations Decolonization Committee has approved a resolution that asks the International Court of Justice to urgently intervene on Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. The resolution also requests that the ICJ weigh in on the regime's settlement activities and annexation of Palestinian lands. The document says Israeli actions violate Palestinians' right to self-determination. The resolution was supported by 98 countries against 17 and 52 abstentions. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki has hailed the development as a diplomatic and legal breakthrough to hold Israel accountable for its war crimes. The ICJ also ruled in 2004 that the Israeli separation wall in the occupied West Bank was illegal. Bahrain is holding parliamentary and municipal elections in an environment that human rights groups have described as political repression. The vote is taking place as the Manama regime has dissolved main opposition groups and cracked down on dissent. The restrictions have prompted calls by Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qasim, to boycott the elections. Rights groups say the ban on opposition candidates means the elections will bring no meaningful results. They say the ban signifies the denial of human rights that has gripped Bahrain for years. The Saturday elections determine the fate of seats at the 40-member lower house of parliament. Members of the upper house, which has the same number of seats, are appointed by the king himself. Bahrain insists that its elections are democratic. Abdul Rauf al-Shayab is a Bahraini human rights activist who has been sentenced to death in absentia by a Bahraini court. In an interview with Press TV's Hidden Files program, he explained how people in Bahrain have faced discrimination over the years.
Let's say the father of this king in Bahrain right now was a little bit better than him, and his grandfather better than his father. So the more we are going for the generation down, the more they get worse. It means they become more dictatorship. They become more oppression against and aggressive against our nation there in Bahrain. So there is a very wide discrimination against the people in Bahrain. They use them like slaves. And that's why we don't have our right. That's why we stand to ask people support, that we have to get our independence from this government and to rule ourselves by the constitution we have. The majority of Bahrainian people, whether they are Sunni or Shia, nobody supporting the government for normalization with Zionist regime. Everybody hate this regime because it's come as like a cancer in our Islamic body. So we have to get rid of Zionist regime.
Meanwhile, the wife of a jailed Saudi activist expresses deep concern over the fate of her husband after she lost contact with him on October 23. Maha al-Qahtani is based in the United States. She says she spoke with Muhammad al-Qahtani every day since he was sentenced to 10 years in Saudi jail in 2013. Now, Maha says the fact that communication has been completely cut off shows that something is being hidden. She says she has run out of patience after keeping silent for a decade. Muhammad was jailed for crimes including sedition. He was a founding member of the Saudi Civil and Political Rights Association, an NGO documenting rights abuses. Saudi Arabia is notorious for repression and human rights violations. The kingdom has intensified its crackdown on critics under the de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman. Also, Russian and UN officials have held talks on the possible extension of the deal on exporting grain and fertilizers via the Black Sea days before the agreement expires. A UN statement says the discussions focused on the progress made in facilitating the export of food and fertilizers originating from the Russian Federation to global markets. The Black Sea Grains Agreement was brokered by the UN and Turkey in July and runs out on November 19. It allowed the export of millions of tons of grains, food and fertilizers blocked in ports across Europe due to the war in Ukraine. Now, Russia and Ukraine jointly produce 30% of the world's wheat and 70% of sunflower oil. The Ukraine war goes on. That's what the Ukrainian foreign minister has said a day after his country proclaimed the victory in the southern city of Kherson following the withdrawal of Russian forces.
We won the battle for Kherson. Kherson in the south, it was quite an exercise, I must say, but the war goes on.
In his address to the ASEAN summit in Cambodia, Dmytro Kuleba said Ukrainian forces are winning battles on the ground. He added Kiev will continue to count on the West's military support by the time Russia keeps bringing more weapons and mobilizing drafts to Ukraine. On Friday, Moscow said it had pulled out troops of the entire pocket it held on the west bank of the Dnipro River, including the city of Kherson. Ukrainian forces have now entered the city months after it fell to Russia. Moscow annexed Kherson in September and says the city's status remains unchanged even after the troop pullout. Activist and political analyst John Bosnich tells us what prompted Russia's withdrawal and what its future plans could be.
This is an extended war now, and it's gone on for some time, and Russia has a large exposed front line. And it is normal in any kind of a military operation, and I've covered wars in various regions for some time, it's very important to consolidate your forces. And Russia is obviously now going to spearhead a new offensive, but it's going to do it on Russia's terms and not on the terms of Ukraine. The Ukrainians do not have the trained personnel to run much of the weaponry that they're receiving from the West, from NATO countries, who are fighting basically a proxy war using Ukrainians as cannon fodder. Russia, on the other hand, is taking very careful consideration of the seeking power of any of the Western weapons that have been brought into the conflict zone. And by withdrawing the mass of its human resources out of the range of those guns, Russia is now able to pick where it will strike and when without any concern about the Western response. This is a great strategic advantage that Russia has and Ukraine does not have.
And that wraps up World Bulletin for this hour.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture. Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, a Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet or you put it on the end of a shell and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey, guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse because, you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. Depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait?
how it happened for you.
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started, and at that time I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer, particularly in this hospital. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfolds. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security, and he knows about the problem. And he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that we got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad Al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. Some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach. Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role.
Très bien, à tout de suite.
I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, can I go inside? It's not mine. No, it's not mine. You can go in. I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra Hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desbordes has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, the fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down, and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, and Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who, like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory seven times in September 1995. And fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenović is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadići factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people. And less than 5% of them came from Hadići. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac Municipal Cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadići. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadići. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Relja, Puša Ramomir, Turuntaš Ljubica, Valušić Gospod, Udrić.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by, and they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalevich is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadići, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests revealed that his prostate is 4 times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before, I could take normal showers. But now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh, yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.
I pursue the depleted uranium trail in Italy. A great ally of the USA within NATO, the country organized humanitarian missions in Bosnia. It later sent a strong contingent to separate Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo. And it was in Italy that the dangers of depleted uranium weapons were widely exposed in late 1999. In Rome, I meet another Italian soldier who'd been sent to the Balkans, Colonel Americo Lacetti.
So it began in 1999.
I came back in 1999, and on December 24th, I had an X-ray. I remember I was alone with the technician. There was nobody at the hospital. When I asked him what I had, he said, "What have you got?" And then he said, "Enjoy Christmas, because you won't be here next year." I had this lump, 24 centimeters long, 14 centimeters wide, and 12 centimeters thick. A tumor in my lungs. After that, I had other tests, and they took a piece of the tumor and examined it. Inside were numerous ceramic particles, perfectly round. And they contained a load of substances that don't exist naturally. But they do exist when a depleted uranium projectile strikes a hard surface. This produces a cloud of dust, which when you inhale it, creates this type of pathology. I'm now living in a body that's mined.
As the death toll builds in Italy, the public is outraged, and the government has to act. On January the 3rd, 2001, the Prime Minister, Giuliano Amato, breaks the official silence and announces that he is going to demand a full account from NATO. But this demand will have little effect.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم everyone, dear sisters and brothers. Welcome to a new episode of For a Better Life. This is IRB English Radio. I'm Asma, and today I have the pleasure to be at your service. I keep reminding you that in here, I neither wish to preach nor that I am a preacher. It's just some moments for thinking that we go through it all together. Life and all the dramas that comes with it are the things that would sometimes wig us out. And this is going to be the certain of our topic for today's program. As we all grow older, we start to see some different secrets of life to get unfolded before our eyes. We come to understand that this life is not going to be a wonderland, and we are not going to play the role of a child who's in a candy store. So things will happen, drama will happen, and sometimes we come to think of ourselves as a tragic figure in a heartrending, heartbreaking story that's been more of a loser. And this could happen to all of us. Actually, I'm not talking about something which is very much far-fetched. No, many times it happened for me, for you, for every single one who has a heart and a brain, that we feel like, okay, I'm a loser. I tried so much. I wanted something pretty much. And then with all the efforts I made, I got nothing. I actually achieved nothing. There is no single person in this world who could claim that I never had a taste of sorrow or depression upon my tongue, or that life has always been running according to my will. This could be the most flagrant lie ever, and now I'm just pronouncing it here with full energy because it is the truest thing I should ever say. So do not ever have this in mind because, you know, as human beings, sometimes it occurred to us that we think that, okay, all these drudgeries, all these dilemmas, all these hardships are happening to me alone. And all the people out there are living their life and their problems. Maybe they have problems, but it is not as big as my problems and dilemmas. Sometimes we keep saying to ourselves, okay, what did I achieve? I technically got none of my wishes, nor that I reached any of my goals. Am I a loser? Okay, keep it right in here, and let's go for a tad of a break, and we'll have more of this topic in For a Better Life. Welcome back, and thank you for staying with us. We are pondering upon the dark thoughts of remorse, despair, and depression that might eat us in life. We all know that being a human who's got a touchy heart and a logical brain is such a difficult burden, but that's what the whole story is about. Nobody has ever promised us to come to this world in order to live a life which is all pity. No problem, no sadness, no sorrow, and all happiness. Well, it has never been like that. Allah has created us and will put us into some tests, but He's not expecting us to do more than the vigors He's put in us. Already, He's aware of the amount of capacities I hold inside myself. But you know, it's more like this. The Creator has created me. He knows my capacities. He sent me into this world, and He's pretty much sure that He has given me enough of vigor to tolerate whatever He's going to put in my plate. So it's not just like we've been created and then sent to this world and then left alone. This is the good news, you know? Plenty much of things would happen to me, but this is not going to be the end of the world because God is out there and He's going to be always caring for me, taking care of me, and watching over me. So things are not as tragic as we sometimes interpret it to be. Whatever I'm supposed to do is to do all my best and never give up. That's all my mission I have to do in this life, aside from knowing myself, getting closer to my Lord, and understanding the very fact that life is not going to last forever. Whatever I do in this world is just going to be a mean that is going to help me in the world to come. I should actually focus on these points. Still, with all the things that we said, sometimes this very idea that I've lost many games in my life makes us depressed. We feel blue just out of sudden. We might even seclude ourselves from the entire world and all the people and then turn into a pessimist. And right at this point, life gets no meaning and you find it no longer inspiring to make you get going, which is actually a dangerous sickness that needs perfect care and attention. And I'm saying this seriously. Sometimes the amount of darkness inside of us gets to a pinnacle that really needs a mediator, someone whom you trust and you could talk to him or her, and then they could help you with some even medicines, because truly there are plenty much of people who are suffering from these thoughts, and these thoughts are going crazy inside their brain. When it comes to this point, it really needs a doctor, a scholar, someone who could help you out, because chances that things would get out of your control and then you might do something wrong to yourself or even to the other people who are living around you.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Regretting the past and worrying about the future are two mental disturbances which inflict many people and put hurdles in their right way of life. That's why the Holy Book of Quran and the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam keeps reminding us of our values and of the true nature of time and life. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, life consists of 3 days. First, the day which has passed and never comes back again. Second, the present day in which people are living and it is under the control of people and they may use it wisely. And third is tomorrow, for which people are waiting. Concerning the worries for future and regret for the days that are gone, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, do not awaken inside yourself the events of the past, since it will hinder your future development. And do not impose the onset tomorrow upon the present time, and don't add to your today's load. What tasks each day brings upon will suffice your day. Also, he says, do not worry upon what you have lost in this world. And it actually is the whole idea of living. I'm just telling you that regret, the feeling of being a loser, this loss that sometimes gets over us, and many times reproaches us for not doing this or that, is not always true. Sometimes it happens that we're having a wrong idea about ourselves, about our abilities. And many times it happens that we're forgetting our relationship with Allah. So the thing that really is going to help us get out of these dilemmas, the thing that is going to come to our rescue, is the connection we have to our Lord, the one we are sure that is never going to leave us, the one that we are pretty much assured that is going to help us out and find a way for us to finally be saved. To wrap it all up, I would say that life is not an easy thing to do. We have plenty much of difficult things to go through. There are tests, there are situations, there are dramas and tragedies that might happen to us. But the thing that matters is that Allah is going to help us through. And you're not alone, of course, so have no regret in life. Even if it happens to you, try not to give it any head or try not to pay attention to it. Just ignore it and make sure that it happens to every single creature who lives in this world. Well, that's it. This is all the time that we have for today's episode of For a Better Life. You are listening to IRB English Radio. Until another session, I bid you farewell and I will leave you to God's never sleeping eyes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every
shade of palm, every closed hand in us, every sparkling tear on every eyelash in us, every thought I have and every word I share.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.